What's up, y'all? This is your host, Jeremy Jackson, with the Sports Medicine Broadcast. Some of this information is going to be coming from the Sports Medicine update provided by Memorial Hermann and Bob Marley and his team there. And thanks to Brad Brown, because he also hooked me up with a spot at SWATA, where I was able to interview NATA President Scott Saylor. That'll be coming eventually. Dr. Josh Yellen at U of H MAT. Let me record a presentation from Dr. Mark Merrick, so that'll be coming at you soon. And I was also really excited to tell you guys about this. sportshealth.com/SMB. sportshealth.com/SMB. Password for August is Samuel, S-A-M-U-E-L. The password for September is Jonah, J-O-N-A-H. Those are two of my sons. It's Samuel and Jonah. That's a password. When you go to sportshealth.com/SMB, you can enter to win $50 each month that you have the password. So each month you listen to the podcast, you get the password, you can listen. Those are August and September passwords. So sportshealth.com/SMB. It's a great opportunity for you, great opportunity for me, great opportunity for them, for you to build that relationship. I've been pleasantly pleased with their service so far. Greg Evans is doing a great job running the team there at School Health for the sports medicine side. He is an athletic trainer, so he knows athletic trainers and knows what athletic trainers need. So check them out there at School Health. So sportshealth.com/SMB. Again, the easiest way is join the email list from the Sports Medicine Broadcast. That's where I send out the link. I send out the password. It's already there. You don't have to remember to try and write it down. You can click on it while you're sitting there at your desk or on your phone, not driving in traffic, but not texting or emailing while you're driving in traffic. There you go. So just when you're sitting stopped, waiting for somebody or waiting at a game. So again, this is Jeremy, Sports Medicine Broadcast. Lots of content this summer, lots of great stuff, and I'm super excited about the opportunity with School Health. Thanks.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here. So, as Bob mentioned, I'm very happy to do this this year. I'm very excited about this because I wanted to do this for a while. You know, one of my big interests and my big passions is spine injuries and sports. So now we're actually going to do a section for you guys going through spine injuries and sports. So my presentation is going to cover more the medical aspects of spine injuries and sports, different conditions. Then Brian, who's an excellent physical therapist, especially spine therapist, is going to go through the principles of spine rehabilitation. And then the breakout sessions, I'm going to go through how I approach an athlete who has low back pain, say someone who goes to my clinic, how I examine them. And then Brian's going to go through the basics of spine rehab. And really the idea is to give you some really good take-home points, take-home messages, tools you can use in your training room when you have athletes who come in with low back pain.
All right.
So I'm going to cover some of the things that I'll cover with this presentation. I'll cover the epidemiology, basic considerations for assessment, common injuries. And if there's time, I'm actually going to go through a study I did when I was working with Dr. Andrews looking at low back pain in college and professional athletes, and more college and professional baseball players. So spine injuries. So this is the lumbar spine here. In all of its glory. You know, you have your cervical, thoracic, and lumbar segments. Then you have the sacrum and the coccyx, which are actually more few segments there. When we look at low back pain just in general, all right, so everyone gets low back pain pretty much. If you look at the studies, you know, 85-90% of the adult population has had back pain at some point in their life. And generally within 6 weeks, it gets better. If you look at athletes, anywhere between 10 to 25% of all sports injuries are related to the spine, if you look at the data. What we're noticing, though, is that the prevalence of athletes tends to be underreported. A lot of the time is because the majority of acute neck and low back pain athletes are very self-limited and respond well to conservative management. But it's like for these, so really it's more, this talk is more geared to those athletes who, after like, you know, a couple days, you're still having problems with the low back, or you're seeing worrisome signs of this might be a more significant back injury than just a lumbar sprain. The more common sports that we see low back injuries: wrestling, weightlifting, rowing, gymnastics, golf is a big one as well. It is a common cause of lost playing time in athletes. Up to 30% of lost playing time can be counted for low back injuries, 15% in basketball, up to 38% in professional tennis players. And golfers get back pain all the time. It's probably the top injury that we see in golf, the back and wrist injuries. What can be really confounding too is that if you were to image a lot of these athletes, a lot of times they'll have abnormalities on their MRI or their x-rays, but they won't be symptomatic. So a researcher did a really nice study looking at 33 asymptomatic elite tennis players around the age of 17. Almost 85% of them has some abnormality on imaging. So at least a third had some form of facet arthropathy. Two-thirds had facet arthropathy. Almost a third had some form of disc abnormalities. And this, they imaged them by MRI, by the way. Some of them had synovial cysts, and some of them had pars defects. But once again, these are athletes who did not complain of low back pain, and they were playing at a very high level. Some of the common risk factors you look for low back pain prior injury. If you had back problems in the past, you're more likely to have them in the future. And you have to look at equipment, footwear, flexibility, core strengthening, conditioning, and age also is a risk factor as well. So as I mentioned before, looking at the basic spine anatomy, 7 cervical, 12 thoracic, 5 lumbar vertebra, and then you have 5 sacral, which are fused. We have very rudimentary discs, which really don't cause an issue. And then you have 4 costigial bones, which are also fused. So the spine itself is not a very stable structure. And you don't want it to be too flexible, otherwise you won't have a lot of range of motion. What really stabilizes the spine are the muscles around the spine area. And those muscles are really integral for rehabilitation. And also, when you start to have chronic back injuries, those muscles start to atrophy, which can kind of cause this kind of negative cycle, which can cause chronic low back pain. If we look at the spine here, you have your spinal canal right along it here. The nerve roots run through the spinal canal. Your spinal cord will typically end at L1. And then you have the nerve foramen, which you see here, where the nerve roots run out of. And of course, you have your discs, which are almost essentially your shock absorbers, or the cushions between your lumbar vertebra. So I'm going to go through assessment of low back pain in my breakout session, but there are a couple mnemonics I want you guys to be familiar with. One is chloride, and this is what I teach my residents when they're rotating with me in clinic. There might be a lot of different mnemonics you guys know. This is one I like to use. Chloride characterizes the pain, location, which is extremely important. A lot of times with my athletes, I tell them with one finger, point to me where it hurts the most, because that'll really give you an idea like what you're dealing with, what the problem area might be. It really will hone down your differential quite a bit. You'd be surprised. Radiation is important, especially worried about disc injury, lumbar radiculopathy. Intensity, duration, exacerbating, alleviating factors are very, very important. Especially if you have a patient coming in and you notice when they're in the clinic, they can't sit down, and they really have to, they're kind of shifting their chair a lot. You have to think there might be a disc issue until proven otherwise. I also look at past history and family history are very, very important as well. Some of the red flags to look out for: night symptoms, constitutional symptoms such as fevers, chills, night sweats, malaise, weight loss. If they have spinous process tenderness, you want to be very careful, especially in a trauma situation that might indicate fracture. Neurologic compromise, of course, is very important. Weakness, sensory changes, bowel and bladder dysfunction, and severe intractable pain. If you have any of these symptoms there, that means it probably needs to be seen by a physician sooner rather than later. So there are a lot of different causes of low back pain, as you can see here. We're only going to cover a very small section of this of the differential. We're going to go through muscle strain, degenerative changes, disc herniations, and spondylolysis. Those will be the big topics we're going to cover today. One more mnemonic I want to share with you guys, too. When you have someone coming in with low back pain, which kind of help you kind of categorize what might be going on, is MD-PROM. Now, I apologize ahead of time that I didn't get this talk to you guys, but this will be provided to you online. And also, if you ever have questions, I'll provide my email address for you as well. But MD-PROM is another one. I learned this in residency, actually. But these are different potential causes for low back pain: myofascial, discogenic, psychogenic, radicular, anything other causes like trauma, infectious, metastatic disease, and the mechanical, which would be also be like degenerative disc disease or facet arthropathy. Now, the reason why we separate discogenic and radicular is because, most of the time we have radiculopathy, it's going to be related to disc herniation, but there are situations such as diabetes or infectious causes which can cause lumbar radiculopathy. So you don't necessarily have to have a disc herniation to have radiculopathy. That's very important to remember. So lumbar strain. Lumbar strain really is related to more myofascial low back pain. And that's probably the most common injury you see for the lumbar spine. A lot of times it's going to be a lumbar strain. And what happens with any muscle strain is you get disruption of the muscle fibers at various locations. It can be the muscle belly or the myotendinous junction. You know, typically you want to try and kind of head them off at the pass and treat them acutely, because then you want to try to avoid the recurrent and more of the chronic injuries. A lot of times, especially the chronic strain, the radiographic workup, including MRI, is going to be negative. Even on ultrasound, sometimes you can see the muscle strain on ultrasound. You can see like little tears in the muscle bellies and the paraspinal muscles. But even with the ultrasound, you're not necessarily see a chronic muscle strain on imaging. So acute, typically, you treat short rest, physical therapy, focusing on pain control, stretching. You can do anti-inflammatories, muscle relaxants. You know, a lot of times I don't see these in my clinic because these are kids who come to you in your training room, and you guys are very capable of handling these patients, and they generally get better with your treatments. So a lot of times I won't see a lot of the acute muscle strains. Return to play generally happens with a completely pain-free, full range of motion, normal strength and endurance. If they have chronic problems, you want to look at the causative factor and also rule out, make sure there's nothing else going on, like a disc herniation or spondylolysis or other abnormalities or even a possible fracture, God forbid. You really want to figure out what they're doing that's causing this, because they're doing something that's causing it. If they kind of have chronic muscle strain, they're doing something that's bringing this on. So you want to try to identify these factors. Is there a muscle imbalance? Is it hamstring flexibility? Do they have a subtle scoliosis? No one's diagnosed. Things like that. So that's the important thing with chronic muscles, with a chronic lumbar strain. So lumbar disc herniation, I'm going to spend a pretty decent amount of time on this one, because this is probably the bane of my existence. Out of all the disc injury or all the injuries for low back, this one is the most problematic one. Not only because, it can be very debilitating, short term, but then you have to think of long term implications as well. And as Bob mentioned before, we just started a weightlifting injury prevention course. And the big reason why I started doing, or we put this together, was because I was getting kids who were like 15, 16 with disc herniations looking like this. You get their MRI and you see this sort of thing. I mean, you shouldn't see that in anybody, but when you start to see, disc bulges or disc abnormalities of people who are in there, it should be, you expect someone like in the late 40s and someone who's 15-year-old, that's a problem. It's something, we need to kind of figure out why that's happening. So when you see a lumbar disc herniation, it's actually really a pretty large degree of continuum in terms of what happened. So your normal disc actually is really, it's more like a gel cushion. So you have the annulus here, which are very, very thick fibers which hold the central part of it, the nucleus pulposus there. The nucleus pulposus is a water-based gel, has the consistency of toothpaste. Some people even call it crab meat, but it's more like a kind of a toothpaste sort of consistency. Now, this probably the earliest abnormality will be what we call annular tear. We actually just tear the annulus. So the nucleus pulposus is going to be fine, but it's going to tear that disc lining right along there. Now, it actually can be a big abnormality because what's in that disc lining is also a lot of small nerve fibers. It can be extremely painful, extremely aggravating. So annular tear is probably the small, lowest, in terms of disc injury, the most minor. And then you start to go to disc protrusion, where you start to have the nucleus pulposus start to leak out with the annular tears, as you can see there. Then you can progress to a disc extrusion, where the nucleus pulposus extrudes out and actually starts to go into the spinal canal, hit the nerve root. And disc sequestration is the worst case, and that's basically where that nucleus pulposus breaks off and actually can float about in the spinal canal, which can be a pretty big issue because it can actually hit more than one nerve root, affect more than one nerve root. The diagram at the bottom here is the lumbar spine MRI. This is a T2 weighted image. We're looking at a sagittal view here on the left and an axial cut here on the right-hand side. And you can see at L5-S1, you can see a disc herniation right along in there, right there. Now, this particular individual has multiple disc abnormalities, but you can see the disc herniation kind of going right into the canal there. Now, on the axial cut, so this is the right side, this is the left side, you can see the disc kind of go into the central canal, and this structure here is your nerve root, so the disc is actually impinging on the nerve root. One other thing that's important to note, too, and actually I've started doing this more myself, because at first I really wasn't doing it. I wasn't really kind of present to the importance of doing that. But I always look at the lumbar paraspinal muscles. Can you see that there? See, I have like kind of a lot of light, kind of grayish, kind of fatty changes there. You really want to look at for that too, because that really tells the person, can give you an idea, one, you know, how long they've had this problem. Because we know that when you have a disc herniation, it automatically will start to shut down those lumbar paraspinal muscles. But two, it'll kind of give you an idea too, like, what to expect in terms of rehabilitation. If they have pretty good muscle bulk here, you know, they might, you know, the therapist might have a little bit of an easier time to get them better. If they have a lot of atrophy, as you see here, we just really don't see, so the dark here should be the muscle fibers. You see a lot of kind of gray, fatty atrophy, that whitish, grayish right there. If you see a lot of that, then, you know, therapy will help them, but it's going to be take a little bit longer in terms of trying to build that muscle bulk back up. Perfect. So a couple things on basic physical examination. You know, a lot of times people come into your office, they'll have a lot of pain with forward flexion, difficulty with sitting, and they can't find a comfortable position. And once again, a lot of times when I have these, you know, people with acute disc herniation come into my office, these will be people where they're standing. They have severe back pain, but they just cannot sit down. If they sit, they can sit for maybe 30 seconds, they have to get back up again. Even when you examine them, I mean, when I examine them, I generally have them sit on the table for a very short period of time because I know that's probably going to exacerbate their symptoms. Also too, with a disc herniation, what can happen is it can hit the nerve root. So sometimes you'll have lower extremity numbness, paresthesias, and weakness. And on the diagram to the right here, we're going to go through physical exams in the second section. But you know, this is an example of the straight leg raise test here, which can help diagnose or is indicative of a person having a lumbar radiculopathy. Okay. Perfect. Now, if you look at the adolescent and teen population for disc herniations, it's not the most common problem that you'll see in the teen population in terms of back injury. But looking at the data, average age is 15 years. So about age 15 is when you see sort of kids having disc herniations. In the past, it was thought that it was more common in males than females. However, the most recent study is actually that trend is shifting. So we're not really sure what the gender predilection is at this point. And actually now it might be more females opposed to males. Family history is extremely important with adolescents who have disc herniation because 43% of the time, if they have a disc herniation, they have a first-degree relative who's also had a lumbar disc herniation as well. So family, there's a very strong genetic link or hereditary link with this problem. And most of the times, they've had some first-degree relatives has some form of low back pain, whether it be degenerative disc disease, disc herniation, or whatnot. Most of the time, it's going to be related to sports or trauma. Yeah, you use surgery if there's motor loss, cauda equina symptoms, which are, you know, weakness, bowel bladder dysfunction. You know, almost like people, you know, really have almost paralysis from the waist down after these injuries. That's cauda equina syndrome or intractable pain. So if you look at the data, about 7% of the cases in college athletes with low back pain will have disc herniations. It can be difficult to diagnose in the younger athletes because they are less likely to have radicular symptoms. They may not admit their true level of pain, so that can actually delay treatment. A lot of times you can do conservative management. You do surgery if they've failed conservative treatment or if they have severe neurologic compromise. So if they have a severe foot drop or cannot, you know, stand on their toes or have severe numbness or paresthesias, that's when you can think about, or if they failed other treatments such as physical therapy, epidural steroid injections, that's when you think about doing a microdiscectomy. Your goal for the non-surgical treatment, a couple things you want to keep in mind. First thing you want to do is stop the inflammation and stop the pain. So I'm generally pretty aggressive if someone has acute disc herniation. You know, if I think they can tolerate them, I'll do like a measurable dose pack or a steroid pill pack to really shut down the inflammation and the pain. I'll get them into therapy as quickly as I can. One thing you want to do also is restore strength, restore flexibility, address underlying imbalances. Then eventually, once you do that, you can start restore aerobic conditioning, balance and coordination. You can adapt them to a sport-specific exercise program, you know, correct and proper technique, and then eventually kind of start them on the return to play protocol. And that protocol really can vary depending on the athlete. So sometimes if the pain is really severe, or if they're not really responding to physical therapy or other medications, I'm not a big fan of using narcotics, period, for low back pain. The studies really just don't support that, actually. And especially in a younger population, high school, college athlete, I really don't like using narcotics at all. One good option, which I've used in the past, actually has worked well, are the epidural steroid injections. So this is actually, you know, there are a couple of different ways you can do the epidural injection. Typically, you do what we call the transforaminal approach. So you're actually going kind of near the neuroforamen. Now, I don't do the injections myself. I generally send them to a board-certified pain management specialist, and I would strongly urge anyone who's considering you want to go to or have this done by a board-certified pain management specialist who pretty much they just do this day in and day out, because there are a lot of very, you know, technical aspects to this particular procedure. The x-ray to the right actually shows the fill for lumbar after doing an epidural steroid injection. So actually what they do, once they localize needle placement with fluoroscopy, they shoot a little bit of contrast at it and make sure you can see that you can trace out the nerve root. So actually tracing out the nerve root with contrast at it and make sure they're in the right spot, then they inject the corticosteroid. So that way they know exactly where they're going. Now, this has actually been done in professional athletes, and there are actually studies supporting the use of epidural steroid injections. One study was done in NFL players, and they had 17 players with lumbar disc herniations. They had 27 disc herniations, 37 injections. They had an 89% success rate. So 24 out of 27 episodes with disc herniations got better. They really didn't lose too much practice time, and they lost virtually no playing time in the actual, in the regular season games. Four players had to have repeat epidural, so typically one injection does a trick for these, for this population. But, you know, one athlete had to have repeat epidural, four players had to have repeat epidural steroid injections. And when you start to have repeat epidurals, these guys, three out of four of them eventually end up having surgery. So the risk factors for failing epidurals, if they had a disc sequestration, an MRI, or had they had weakness in physical examination, they didn't do as well with the epidural injections. But typically, though, if you have a disc sequestration, or you know, you have a disc fragment floating about in your spinal canal, or you have severe weakness in physical examination, generally you really are thinking about sending them to the surgeon sooner rather than later, because you don't want to let that sit. So there's another study done looking at surgical outcomes in professional athletes in general. And this is probably the largest study that I've seen in the literature looking at the outcomes of surgery or disc herniations in professional athletes. So this was done by Wellington Sue's group and Northwestern in Chicago. So what they did is they were able. They're able to look at 342 athletes among the four major professional sports, baseball, hockey, basketball, and the NFL. And looked at between 1972 and 2008. So they got 342 athletes. Over 200 of them had a lumbar discectomy. 116 players were treated non-operatively. They did at least a two-year follow-up. One of the big things, though, is that there was no statistical significant difference in the return to play rates or career length in the operative, non-operative cohorts. So if you have surgery or if you don't have surgery, outcomes in terms of return to play and also in terms of career length were pretty much the same. You really weren't worse by surgery, but you weren't necessarily that much better either than if you were treated non-surgically. A couple things that kind of were negative predictors. If you had age of diagnosis, so if you're older and you had to have the disc herniation, less chance you're going to go back to return to play. If you had a pretty good career before your disc herniation, you actually had a pretty good chance of going back afterwards. Interestingly enough, Major League Baseball players is the highest return to play. However, their careers were the shortest after they had the surgery. Or if they had disc herniation, whereas NFL players had the lowest return to play, but they actually did pretty well after having a lumbar discectomy. So this was a rather interesting study. but there are a couple things they didn't mention in that particular paper. One thing, and it was kind of tough to do because they're looking at, you know, for such a broad range, you're looking at over a 36-year period. They didn't really detail what sort of physical therapy the athletes had. They didn't really detail how many of them had epidural steroid injections before their surgery. And nor did they really detail, like, the extent of the disc herniation. They really didn't stratify for that. And it was kind of tough to do just because they were pooling so much data. And, you know, in terms of not everyone had the same amount of fastidiousness with record keeping, let's say. But Robert Watkins, who's a really well-known spine surgeon in California, operates on a lot of athletes, really summed it up best. Great rehabilitation and great physical bodies allow professional athletes undergo a lumbar discectomy to return after sport at a high rate. So, I mean, that sums it up really right there, because you have to think about, well, who's your population? So if you're, you know, if you're doing the general population, you have people who are motivated to get better, not so motivated to get better. But you're doing the surgery in a particular population where, you know, they have multi-million-dollar contracts, so they have a very strong incentive to get better. They're also they're great athletes. The time for diagnosis is a lot faster. They're going to get their MRI. They don't have to worry about insurance with getting their MRIs. They don't have to wait 3-day period, or you don't have to do, or I don't have to, you know, make phone calls to an insurance company to get the MRI approved. They're going to get it done pretty much that day. In fact, they might even get it done right in the training room, depending on the kind of facility they have. And not only that, they have a lot of more resources to get to do the rehabilitation afterwards that most people don't have. So you always have to kind of keep that in mind as well. When you're looking at this data. However, looking at other data for disc herniations and surgery after with sports. So they've done some like separate case control studies for the NBA and Major League Baseball. Now, for the NBA players, they did a smaller study, and what's interesting is that the surgery group had fewer games played. However, those in surgery tend to do better had better blocking or rebounding after the surgery, but they didn't play as long. And centers tend to be more likely to have surgery than the forwards or the guards. And another case series, there are 64 baseball players. 40 players had surgery, 29 did not. But this surgery group had fewer games played after surgery and decreased performance. So that's really important to know. They didn't really do as well postoperatively, as a non-operative group. And one of the reasons why is that when you think about baseball, especially with pitchers, they have so much rotational force they place on their spines. They put a lot of rotation on their spine constantly, day in and day out. So it's going to be it's really tough to get these players back after they have a surgery like that. Okay. And then NFL, once again, NFL players tend to do pretty well. They'll tell linemen. Linemen do pretty well with this after the surgery. Most of them are able to get back to return to play without any major issues. And they tend to do better than the non-surgical group, but the non-surgical group was much smaller in this particular study. So return to play criteria, you want full strength, full range of motion, pain-free, ideally without medications. Certainly you don't want them on narcotics trying to get back into their sport. You want to make sure they really don't have any abnormal movement patterns. You want to advance them to functional, sport-specific drills and activities. And you really can't keep in mind, it's going to be kind of a slow progression to activity, to return to activity. Now, Brian's going to talk about a little bit later about the different, you know, basics for rehabilitation for these sorts of injuries. But these are some of the basic exercises that you can do in your training room to help rehabilitate after people with lumbar disc injuries. All right. So the big thing you want to prevent with a lot of these injuries is kind of the inevitable kind of progression later on in life. So you want to prevent the degenerative disc disease. And this kind of ended the career of Larry Bird, as you can see there. So we do know that degenerative changes are more common in athletes than non-athletes. However, when you look at these athletes, yeah, they're going to have more changes on x-ray, but they may not necessarily have more low back pain compared to the general population. So a lot of athletes will have degenerative changes, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be symptomatic from it. And there are more increased risk for degenerative changes, but once again, are they going to be worse off functionally in the long term? Studies really aren't showing that necessarily. Now, why are they more at risk for degenerative changes? Well, look at their sport. I mean, a golf swing, you know, any regular golf swing can put up to almost a ton of force through a disc segment. A football lineman blocking, the compressive load is up to almost, once again, up to 2 tons. A weightlifter doing a basic squat, depending on how heavy they lift, it can be up to 2 tons of weight of compressive load on their spine. So you have a lot of high forces, you know, transmitted through these disc segments, and keep doing it over and over, year after year, eventually you are going to get degenerative changes. So a lot of times these guys will present with axial low back pain. They may have radicular symptoms, not always. Just remember, symptom severity will not always correlate with radiographic abnormality. You really want to try to treat them conservatively because the other options for surgery aren't great. You can do laminectomy, but a lot of times these guys end up having to go to a fusion. And if you go to a fusion, typically, you know, you're not going to be able to get back into your sport. Okay. So the last condition we're going to talk about is spondylolysis, which you can see right along in here. So this is a CAT scan of sagittal cut of the CAT scan. You look at the spondylolysis there. This is the X-ray. Once again, you can see the spondylolysis right there. So a spondylolysis is a defect in the pars interarticularis. What that is that's actually the little bridge of bone between the inferior and superior articulating processes of your facet joints. So this little section right there. And what can happen is either it never really fully forms, because as a child, that you actually have a small growth plate there, so that growth plate never fully forms or calcifies, or over time, you have high forces transmitted through this area and develop a stress fracture through it. And that stress fracture is called the spondylolysis. Now, what can happen is, eventually, especially if you have it on both sides, you get segment instability, and that segment instability causes a slip called the spondylolisthesis. So looking at the prevalence, you know, in the general population, 3 to 6% of the world's population has a spondylolysis. It can count for, depending on what study you read, it can be anywhere between 13 to 47% of referrals for low back pain in athletes. L5 is the most common level, and a lot of times this is going to be bilateral, which is really important, because if it's bilateral, the likelihood you're going to get bony healing is going to be a lot less than if it's unilateral. And that's actually going to adjust or alter, it might alter your management or how you treat these athletes. It's more common in men than women in the general population. However, in the athletic population, it's more common in female athletes. And it's believed to be, too, just because of the nature of the sport. Gymnastics is probably the most common sport that where you see spondylolysis, so that might be the reason why it's more common in the female population. Most of the time, it's going to be one level, very rarely two levels. I had one case where a kid had three levels consecutively three levels on both sides, with no spondylolisthesis whatsoever. That was unbelievable. What's interesting, if you look at the general population, so there was a really nice study where they looked at 500 kids over a 45-year period to see how many had spondylolysis. Generally, the overall prevalence was 6%. What was interesting, though, is that 4.4% developed it by the age of 6, and the rest developed it by the age of 14. So a lot of times when I have a kid come in, age 13 or 14 or 15, they may have already had this, since they were 6 years old. It just didn't bother them. We do know if you have scoliosis and Sherman's disease, you tend to be at increased risk for these problems, because with the scoliosis and the Sherman's disease, you're going to alter your biomechanics. You're going to put increased stress on those segments. So spondylolisthesis, we grade it. Grade 0 is no slip, and it goes by 25%. So grade 1, anywhere between 1 and 25% of a slip. Grade 2, 26 to 50%. Grade 3, 51 to 75%. Grade 4 and grade 5, pretty much the two bones are almost dislocated and you have pretty significant canal compromise. A lot of times when you look for spondylolisthesis, especially in kids, it's good to do what we call a flexion extension view on X-ray, because a lot of times these spondylolisthesis can be dynamic. So you can do it statically, you may not see it, but if you haven't been forward and been backwards, you might actually see that spondylolisthesis become present. So the true etiology of spondylolisthesis, we're really not sure why this happens. You know, some people think it's a cause of repetitive microtrauma to the spine, so that kind of repetitive extension rotation, but it isn't always proven, because it doesn't explain why a 4-year-old would necessarily be at more increased risk of having spondylolisthesis, even in the general population. So it's a continuum of disease. It can be stress reaction to a spondylolytic defect. And also, once again, genetics plays a role. And we haven't quite identified the genetic factors, but we do know first-degree relatives. If you have a first-degree relative with a spondy, you're more likely to have a spondy. So the high-risk sports, gymnastics is probably number one. Tennis, diving, football, rowing, weightlifting is another common one. And throwing sports, what I mean by throwing sports, I mean like in track and field. So shot putters, discus throwers, javelin throwers tend to be at an increased risk of having spondylolysthesis. So clinical presentation, which only kind of presented as a kind of increased aching back pain. And really, extension is really what's going to bother it. So standing upright, bending backwards will generally kind of increase the pain. This one test you can do is what we call the Stork standing test, which you see here, and which I'll go through later on in the breakout session. But basically, you're doing extension with rotation, and you're trying to increase that pain in the spondylolysthesis, see if you can isolate that spondylolysthesis pain. A lot of times these athletes will have hamstring tightness, and we're not really sure which comes first. Is the hamstring tightness predisposing to spondies, or is it the other way around? We're not really sure yet. And they can have tenderness palpation on examination too. So the first test you do for imaging is radiographs. You can do basic X-rays. If it's relatively new, you may not see it on the X-ray. Okay. A lot of times you'll see it on the lateral view here. You might see it in the oblique view as well. Let me quickly show you. So this is a lateral view here of the X-ray. And once again, the spinal lysis is right along here. And also on the oblique view, you look for the neck of the Scotty dog. So this is the Scotty dog. I traced it out here. This is the ear, which is your inferior process, the eye, and the spinal lysis is right there, that black line. That's where the spondy is, right along in there on the oblique views. Bone scan can also be used, but is not really used as much. Bone scan is great for early injuries, and is great if you just want to see if it's a spondy. That's pretty much what it can tell you. It can tell you if it's spinal lysis. It won't tell you if it's like a disc herniation, muscle strain, or anything else. Plus, you're also injecting radiographic dye into someone's veins. I tend not to like to do that as much. CAT scan is probably one of the best tests to do it. Once again, though, in the pediatric population, you have to be concerned about X-ray exposure or radiation exposure. So generally, we do what we call a thin slice CAT scan. So you kind of really limit to the segment where you think the person has the abnormality. That way, you decrease the amount of exposure or radiation exposure. MRI is okay. Once again, it's great for looking at the early injuries, but with the way they do the MRI protocol, sometimes they just won't be able to get the spinal lysis, just with the way that they organize the MRI or order the MRI. So this is a SPECT scan here, and you can see the spinal lysis kind of lights up on the SPECT scan, so that's the bone scan. And then this is the CAT scan here. You can see the spinal lysis right along there. The advantage of the CAT scan, too, you can actually get an idea of age, if it's new or if it's old. So treatment. Asymptomatic athletes, generally just kind of observe them for full participation. If they're symptomatic, your goal is to get some sort of a union, either bony or fibrous union. So that gap on the CAT scan is not true space. It's actually a cartilage bridge. So sometimes you can get that cartilage bridge to kind of thicken, and that'll stabilize the segment enough that they can do their sports. You want, bony union is the gold standard. That's what you really want. Sometimes you don't always get that. But if you don't get that, it doesn't necessarily mean they can't participate in their sport. So if they're symptomatic, you want to kind of take them out of the sport. Now you can consider bracing. We're going to talk about bracing in a second. I do bracing if I think it has potential for healing and if it's unilateral. If it's bilateral or if it's been there for a while, I don't brace them. Physical therapy is extremely important, more flexion bias exercises, core stabilization, hamstring flexibility. Return to play depends on how long it's been. It can be as soon as 6 weeks or as long as 12 weeks. The 12-weekers are more for the acute injury, if I think they really have a chance for healing. 6-weekers or 4 to 6 weeks, if they've had it for a while, and just try and get them asymptomatic. So return to play when pain-free and full range of motion for the chronic cases. Now, bracing is a controversial topic. Some people don't brace at all, and some people are big proponents of bracing. If you go up to Boston, those guys like to brace. Other parts of the country, they don't like to brace as much. But you have to remember, bracing really helps with pain and proprioception. It reminds the athlete of proper posture, reminds them don't arch their back as much, which is going to exacerbate their symptoms. The brace they use is not going to stabilize the affected segment. So if you have an L5 spondy, that lumbar corset is not going to stabilize the segment. You would have to actually cast them from chin all the way down to the tailbone to really stabilize that segment, which no one in the right mind is going to go through. And it's not necessary either. Bracing really has not been shown to increase or improve bony healing. That's the other thing too. There's really nothing showing that the bones, you're going to really necessarily increase bony healing. And if it's chronic, it's not going to do anything for the injury. I tend to do bracing for acute unilateral injuries or if they're in severe pain. Now, the reason why I still do it for the acute unilateral injuries is why I still want to remind them that they can't arch their back too much. I just want to remind them to keep that proper body posture so they don't put too much stress on the injury. But I don't keep them in the brace that long, so I'll see them back in about 2 or 3 weeks. And if they're pain-free by that time, I take them out of the brace. Because what I don't want to have happen is I don't want them to start getting muscle atrophy from being braced for too long. Now you can, there are people who allow athletes to play in a brace. There are some athletes where they're good enough that they can pass all your tests and physical examination, but they're not quite there, for instance, for baseball players, they're not quite there where they can really play pain-free. And sometimes some people are allowing them to play in a brace. You can do that if it's kind of like a dire situation, like, you know, say someone that's playing the World Series, for instance. However, I'm not a big proponent of this because if they're still having pain with the spondee, there's something that still needs to be addressed. That's kind of the way I look at it. Surgery you do if they fail conservative treatments or if they start to have neurologic deficits. And of all the spondees I've treated, I've only had one athlete who's had to go undergo surgery. And that particular athlete had two levels, and she was beginning to really get a lot of radicular symptoms. And we did an EMG on her, which showed that she had like radiculopathy, and she was getting a lot of denervation. She failed all the other treatments. But if you have the surgery, it's generally a fusion. And generally, when your return to play after you have this fusion is pretty low. So a lot of times, they're not going to be able to go back to their sport. Right. I don't think I'm going to have time to go through the study that I did on college and professional baseball players, so I'm going to skip through that. But if you're interested, I'm more than happy to talk to you about it. So in conclusion, so key points, you really want to do formal physical therapy is really, really integral for these sorts of injuries. A therapy regimen should be tailored to the athlete. You want to make sure you look at the underlying causative factors, and injury, prevention is the best form of medicine. You always want to make sure you're doing proper training. So once again, if you have any questions or concerns, you can always talk to me afterwards, and here's my email address.